Diana hastily dragged in the previously mentioned keg, and Anne found that it was just sufficiently high to furnish a secure resting place for her feet, but she could not release herself.
"Could I pull you out if I crawled up?" suggested Diana.
Anne shook her head hopelessly.
"No, the splinters hurt too badly. If you can find an axe, you might chop me out, though. Oh, dear, I do really begin to believe that I was born under an ill-omened star."
Diana searched faithfully, but no axe was to be found.
"I'll have to go for help," she said, returning to the prisoner.
"No, indeed you won't," said Anne vehemently. "If you do, the story of this will get out everywhere, and I shall be ashamed to show my face. No, we must just wait until the cop girls come home and bind them to secrecy. They'll know where the axe is and get me out. I'm not uncomfortable as long as I keep perfectly still." Not uncomfortable in body, I mean. I wonder what the cop girls value this house at. I shall have to pay for the damage I've done, but I wouldn't mind that if I were only sure they would understand my motive in peeping in at their pantry window. My sole comfort is that the platter is just the kind I want, and if Miss Copp will only sell it to me, I shall be resigned to what has happened.
What if the cop girls don't come home until after night, or till tomorrow? Suggested Diana.
"If they're not back by sunset, you'll have to go for other assistance, I suppose," said Anne reluctantly. "But you mustn't go until you really have to. Oh, dear, this is a dreadful predicament. I wouldn't mind my misfortunes so much if they were romantic, as Mrs. Morgan's heroines always are, but they are always just simply ridiculous. Fancy what the cop girls will think when they drive into their yard and see a girl's head and shoulders sticking out of the roof of one of their outhouses. Listen! Is that a wagon?"
"No, Diana, I believe it is thunder."
Thunder it was, undoubtedly, and Diana, having made a hasty pilgrimage around the house, returned to announce that a very black cloud was rising rapidly in the northwest.
"I believe we're going to have a heavy thunder shower," she exclaimed in dismay. "Oh, Anne, what will we do?"
"We must prepare for it," said Anne tranquilly. A thunderstorm seemed a trifle in comparison with what had already happened. "You'd better drive the horse and buggy into that open shed. Fortunately, my parasol is in the buggy. Here, take my hat with you. Marilla told me I was a goose to put on my best hat to come to the Tory Road, and she was right, as she always is." Diana untied the pony and drove it into the shed, just as the first heavy drops of rain fell. There she sat and watched the resulting downpour, which was so thick and heavy that she could hardly see Anne through it, holding the parasol bravely over her bare head. There was not a great deal of thunder, but for the best part of an hour the rain came merrily down. Occasionally Anne slanted back her parasol and waved an encouraging hand to her friend, but conversation at that distance was quite out of the question. Finally the rain ceased. The sun came out, and Diana ventured across the puddles of the yard.
"Did you get very wet?" she asked anxiously.
"Oh, no," returned Anne cheerfully. "My head and shoulders are quite dry, and my skirt is only a little damp where the rain beat through the lathes. Don't pity me, Diana, for I haven't minded it at all. I kept thinking how much good the rain will do, and how glad my garden must be for it, and imagining what the flowers and buds would think when the drops began to fall. I imagined out a most interesting dialogue between the asters and the sweet peas and the wild canaries in the lilac bush and the guardian spirit of the garden. When I go home, I mean to write it down. I wish I had a pencil and paper to do it now, because I dare say I'll forget the best parts before I reach home."
Diana the Faithful had a pencil and discovered a sheet of wrapping paper in the box of the buggy. Anne folded up her dripping parasol, put on her hat, spread the wrapping paper on a shingle Diana handed up, and wrote out her garden idyll under conditions that could hardly be considered as favorable to literature. Nevertheless, the result was quite pretty, and Diana was enraptured when Anne read it to her.
"Oh, Anne, it's sweet, just sweet. Do send it to the Canadian woman."
Anne shook her head.
"Oh, no, it wouldn't be suitable at all. There's no plot in it, you see. It's just a string of fancies. I like writing such things, but of course nothing of the sort would ever do for publication, for editors insist on plots, so Priscilla says. Oh, there's Miss Sarah Kopp now. Please, Diana, go and explain.
Miss Sarah Kopp was a small person, garbed in shabby black, with a hat chosen less for vain adornment than for qualities that would wear well. She looked as amazed as might be expected on seeing the curious tableau in her yard, but when she heard Diana's explanation, she was all sympathy. She hurriedly unlocked the back door, produced the axe, and with a few skillful blows set Anne free. The latter, somewhat stiff and tired, ducked down into the interior of her prison and thankfully emerged into liberty once more.
"Miss Kopp," she said earnestly, "I assure you I looked into your pantry window only to discover if you had a willow-ware platter. I didn't see anything else. I didn't look for anything else."
"Bless you, that's all right," said Miss Sarah amiably. "You needn't worry. There's no harm done. Thank goodness we cops keep our pantries presentable at all times and don't care who sees into them. As for that old duck house, I'm glad it's smashed, for maybe now Martha will agree to have it taken down. She never would before, for fear it might come in handy sometime, and I've had to whitewash it every spring. But you might as well argue with a post as with Martha. She went to town today. I drove her to the station. And you want to buy my platter? Well, what will you give for it?"
$20, said Anne, who was never meant to match business wits with a cop, or she would not have offered her price at the start.
"Well, I'll see," said Miss Sarah cautiously. "That platter is mine, fortunately, or I'd never dare to sell it when Martha wasn't here. As it is, I dare say she'll raise a fuss. Martha's the boss of this establishment, I can tell you. I'm getting awful tired of living under another woman's thumb. But come in, come in. You must be real tired and hungry. I'll do the best I can for you in the way of tea, but I warn you not to expect anything but bread and butter and some cowcumbers. Martha locked up all the cake and cheese and preserves before she went. She always does, because she says I'm too extravagant with them if company comes."
The girls were hungry enough to do justice to any fare, and they enjoyed Miss Sarah's excellent bread and butter and cowcumbers thoroughly. When the meal was over, Miss Sarah said,
"I don't know as I mind selling the platter. But it's worth $25. It's a very old platter."
Diana gave Anne's foot a gentle kick under the table, meaning, "Don't agree. She'll let it go for 20 if you hold out." But Anne was not minded to take any chances in regard to that precious platter. She promptly agreed to give 25, and Miss Sarah looked as if she felt sorry she hadn't asked for 30.
"Well, I guess you may have it. I want all the money I can scare up just now. The fact is..."
Miss Sarah threw up her head importantly, with a proud flush on her thin cheeks. "I'm going to be married to Luther Wallace. He wanted me 20 years ago. I liked him real well, but he was poor then, and Father packed him off.
I suppose I shouldn't have let him go so meek, but I was timid and frightened of Father. Besides, I didn't know men were so scarce."
When the girls were safely away, Diana driving and Anne holding the coveted platter carefully on her lap, the green, rain-freshened solitudes of the Tory Road were enlivened by ripples of girlish laughter.
"I'll amuse your Aunt Josephine with the strange, eventful history of this afternoon when I go to town tomorrow. We've had a rather trying time, but it's over now. I've got the platter, and that rain has laid the dust beautifully. So all's well that ends well."
"We're not home yet," said Diana, rather pessimistically. "And there's no telling what may happen before we are. You're such a girl to have adventures, Anne."
"Having adventures comes naturally to some people," said Anne serenely. "You just have a gift for them, or you haven't." Chapter 19. Just a Happy Day. "After all," Anne had said to Marilla once, "I believe the nicest and sweetest days are not those on which anything very splendid or wonderful or exciting happens, but just those that bring simple little pleasures following one another softly, like pearls slipping off a string." Life at Green Gables was full of just such days, for Anne's adventures and misadventures, like those of other people, did not all happen at once, but were sprinkled over the year, with long stretches of harmless, happy days between, filled with work and dreams and laughter and lessons. Such a day came late in August. In the forenoon, Anne and Diana rowed the delighted twins down the pond to the sandshore to pick sweetgrass and paddle in the surf, over which the wind was harping an old lyric learned when the world was young. In the afternoon, Anne walked down to the old Irving place to see Paul. She found him stretched out on the grassy bank beside the thick fir grove that sheltered the house on the north, absorbed in a book of fairy tales. He sprang up radiantly at sight of her.
"Oh, I'm so glad you've come, teacher," he said eagerly, "because Grandma's away. You'll stay and have tea with me, won't you? It's so lonesome to have tea all by oneself. You know, teacher, I've had serious thoughts of asking young Mary Jo to sit down and eat her tea with me, but I expect Grandma wouldn't approve. She says the French have to be kept in their place, and anyhow, it's difficult to talk with young Mary Jo. She just laughs and says, 'Well, yous do beat all the kids I ever knowed.' That isn't my idea of a conversation."
"Of course I'll stay to tea," said Anne gaily. "I was dying to be asked. My mouth has been watering for some more of your grandma's delicious shortbread ever since I had tea here before."
Paul looked very sober.
"If it depended on me, teacher," he said, standing before Anne with his hands in his pockets and his beautiful little face shadowed with sudden care, "you should have shortbread with a right good will, but it depends on Mary Jo. I heard Grandma tell her before she left that she wasn't to give me any shortcake because it was too rich for little boys' stomachs, but maybe Mary Jo will cut some for you if I promise I won't eat any. Let us hope for the best."
"Yes, let us," agreed Anne, whom this cheerful philosophy suited exactly. "And if Mary Jo proves hard-hearted and won't give me any shortbread, it doesn't matter in the least, so you're not to worry over that."
"You're sure you won't mind if she doesn't?" said Paul anxiously.
"Perfectly sure, dear heart."
"Then I won't worry," said Paul, with a long breath of relief, "especially as I really think Mary Jo will listen to reason. She's not a naturally unreasonable person, but she has learned by experience that it doesn't do to disobey Grandma's orders. Grandma is an excellent woman, but people must do as she tells them. She is very much pleased with me this morning because I managed at last to eat all my plateful of porridge. It was a great effort, but I succeeded. Grandma says she thinks she'll make a man of me yet. But, teacher, I want to ask you a very important question. You will answer it truthfully, won't you?"
"I'll try," promised Anne.
"Do you think I'm wrong in my upper story?" asked Paul, as if his very existence depended on her reply.
"Goodness no, Paul," exclaimed Anne in amazement. "Certainly you're not. What put such an idea into your head?"
"Mary Jo, but she didn't know I heard her. Mrs. Peter Sloan's hired girl, Veronica, came to see Mary Jo last evening, and I heard them talking in the kitchen as I was going through the hall. I heard Mary Jo say, 'Dat Paul, he is de queerest leetle boy. He talks dat queer. I think dere's something wrong in his upper story.' I couldn't sleep last night for ever so long thinking of it and wondering if Mary Jo was right. I couldn't bear to ask Grandma about it somehow, but I made up my mind I'd ask you. I'm so glad you think I'm all right in my upper story."
"Of course you are. Mary Jo is a silly, ignorant girl, and you are never to worry about anything she says," said Anne indignantly, secretly resolving to give Mrs. Irving a discreet hint as to the advisability of restraining Mary Jo's tongue.
"Well, that's a weight off my mind," said Paul. "I'm perfectly happy now, teacher, thanks to you. It wouldn't be nice to have something wrong in your upper story, would it, teacher? I suppose the reason Mary Jo imagines I have is because I tell her what I think about things sometimes."
"It is a rather dangerous practice," admitted Anne out of the depths of her own experience.
"Well, by and by I'll tell you the thoughts I told Mary Jo, and you can see for yourself if there's anything queer in them," said Paul. "But I'll wait till it begins to get dark. That is the time I ache to tell people things. And when nobody else is handy, I just have to tell Mary Jo. But after this, I won't. If it makes her imagine I'm wrong in my upper story, I'll just ache and bear it."
"And if the ache gets too bad, you can come up to Green Gables and tell me your thoughts," suggested Anne, with all the gravity that endeared her to children, who so dearly love to be taken seriously.
"Yes, I will. But I hope Davy won't be there when I go, because he makes faces at me.
I don't mind very much, because he is such a little boy, and I am quite a big one, but still it is not pleasant to have faces made at you. And Davy makes such terrible ones. Sometimes I am frightened he will never get his face straightened out again. He makes them at me in church when I ought to be thinking of sacred things. Dora likes me, though, and I like her, but not so well as I did before she told Minnie Mae Barry that she meant to marry me when I grew up. I may marry somebody when I grow up, but I'm far too young to be thinking of it yet, don't you think, teacher?
Rather young, agreed teacher. Speaking of marrying, reminds me of another thing that has been troubling me of late, continued Paul. Mrs. Lynde was down here one day last week having tea with Grandma, and Grandma made me show her my little mother's picture, the one Father sent me for my birthday present. I didn't exactly want to show it to Mrs. Lynde. Mrs. Lynde is a good, kind woman, but she isn't the sort of person you want to show your mother's picture to.
You know, teacher, but of course I obeyed Grandma. Mrs. Lynde said she was very pretty and kind of actressy looking, and must have been an awful lot younger than Father. Then she said, "Some of these days your Pa will be marrying again, likely."
"How would you like to have a new Ma, Master Paul?" Well, the idea almost took my breath away, teacher, but I wasn't going to let Mrs. Lynde see that. I just looked her straight in the face like this, and I said, "Mrs. Lynde, Father made a pretty good job of picking out my first mother, and I could trust him to pick out just as good a one the second time."
And I can trust him, teacher. But still, I hope if he ever does give me a new mother, he'll ask my opinion about her before it's too late. There's Mary Jo coming to call us to tea. I'll go and consult her about the shortbread.
As a result of the consultation, Mary Jo cut the shortbread and added a dish of preserves to the bill of fare. Anne poured the tea, and she and Paul had a very merry meal in the dim old sitting room, whose windows were open to the gulf breezes, and they talked so much nonsense that Mary Jo was quite scandalized and told Veronica the next evening that de Schoolmees was as queer as Paul. After tea, Paul took Anne up to his room to show her his mother's picture, which had been the mysterious birthday present kept by Mrs. Irving in the bookcase. Paul's little low-ceilinged room was a soft whirl of ruddy light from the sun that was setting over the sea, and swinging shadows from the fir trees that grew close to the square, deep-set window. From out this soft glow and glamour shone a sweet, girlish face with tender mother eyes that was hanging on the wall at the foot of the bed.
"That's my little mother," said Paul with loving pride. "I got Grandma to hang it there where I'd see it as soon as I opened my eyes in the morning. I never mind not having the light when I go to bed now, because it just seems as if my little mother was right here with me. Father knew just what I would like for a birthday present, although he never asked me. Isn't it wonderful how much fathers do know?"
"Your mother was very lovely, Paul, and you look a little like her. But her eyes and hair are darker than yours."
"My eyes are the same color as Father's," said Paul, flying about the room to heap all available cushions on the window seat. "But Father's hair is gray. He has lots of it, but it is gray. You see, Father's nearly 50. That's ripe old age, isn't it? But it's only outside he's old. Inside he's just as young as anybody. Now, teacher, please sit here, and I'll sit at your feet. May I lay my head against your knee? That's the way my little mother and I used to sit. Oh, this is real splendid, I think."
"Now I want to hear those thoughts which Mary Jo pronounces so queer," said Anne, patting the mop of curls at her side. Paul never needed any coaxing to tell his thoughts, at least to congenial souls.
"I thought them out in the fir grove one night," he said dreamily. "Of course, I didn't believe them, but I thought them, you know, teacher. And then I wanted to tell them to somebody, and there was nobody but Mary Jo. Mary Jo was in the pantry setting bread, and I sat down on the bench beside her, and I said, 'Mary Jo, do you know what I think? I think the evening star is a lighthouse on the land where the fairies dwell.' And Mary Jo said, 'Well, yous are de queer one. There ain't no such thing as fairies.' I was very much provoked. Of course, I knew there are no such thing as fairies, but that needn't prevent my thinking there is. You know, teacher. But I tried again, quite patiently. I said, 'Well then, Mary Jo, do you know what I think? I think an angel walks over the world after the sun sets. A great tall white angel with silvery folded wings, and sings the flowers and birds to sleep. Children can hear him if they know how to listen. Then Mary Jo held up her hands all over Flower and said, "Well, yous are de queer leetle boy. Yous make me feel scared." And she really did look scared. I went out then and whispered the rest of my thoughts to the garden. There was a little birch tree in the garden, and it died. Grandma says the salt spray killed it, but I think the dryad belonging to it was a foolish dryad who wandered away to see the world and got lost. And the little tree was so lonely it died of a broken heart. And when the poor, foolish little dryad gets tired of the world and comes back to her tree, her heart will break, said Anne. Yes, but if dryads are foolish, they must take the consequences, just as if they were real people, said Paul gravely. Do you know what I think about the new moon, teacher? I think it is a little golden boat full of dreams. And when it tips on a cloud, some of them spill out and fall into your sleep. Exactly, teacher. Oh, you do know. And I think the violets are little snips of the sky that fell down when the angels cut out holes for the stars to shine through. And the buttercups are made out of old sunshine. And I think the sweet peas will be butterflies when they go to heaven. Now, teacher, do you see anything so queer about those thoughts? No, laddie dear, they are not queer at all. They are strange and beautiful thoughts for a little boy to think. And so people who couldn't think anything of the sort themselves, if they tried for 100 years, think them queer. But keep on thinking them, Paul. Some day you are going to be a poet, I believe. When Anne reached home, she found a very different type of boyhood waiting to be put to bed. Davy was sulky, and when Anne had undressed him, he bounced into bed and buried his face in the pillow. "Davy, you have forgotten to say your prayers," said Anne rebukingly. "No, I didn't forget," said Davy defiantly. "But I ain't going to say my prayers any more. I'm going to give up trying to be good, because no matter how good I am, you'd like Paul Irving better, so I might as well be bad and have the fun of it."
"I don't like Paul Irving better," said Anne seriously. "I like you just as well, only in a different way."
"But I want you to like me in the same way," pouted Davy.
"You can't like different people the same way. You don't like Dora and me the same way, do you?"
Davy sat up and reflected. "No," he admitted at last. "I like Dora because she's my sister, but I like you because you're you.
And I like Paul because he is Paul, and Davy because he is Davy," said Anne gaily.
"Well, I kind of wish I'd said my prayers then," said Davy, convinced by this logic. "But it's too much bother getting out now to say them. I'll say them twice over in the morning, Anne. Won't that do as well?"
No, Anne was positive it would not do as well. So Davy scrambled out and knelt down at her knee. When he had finished his devotions, he leaned back on his little bare brown heels and looked up at her.
"Anne, I'm gooder than I used to be."
"Yes, indeed you are, Davy," said Anne, who never hesitated to give credit where credit was due.
"I know I'm gooder," said Davy confidently, "and I'll tell you how I know it. Today Marilla gave me 2 pieces of bread and jam, one for me and one for Dora. One was a good deal bigger than the other, and Marilla didn't say which was mine, but I gave the biggest piece to Dora. That was good of me, wasn't it?"
"Very good and very manly, Davy."
"Of course," admitted Davy, "Dora wasn't very hungry, and she only ate half her slice, and then she gave the rest to me. But I didn't know she was going to do that when I give it to her. So I was good, Anne."
In the twilight, Anne sauntered down to the dryad's bubble and saw Gilbert Blythe coming down through the dusky haunted wood. She had a sudden realization that Gilbert was a schoolboy no longer. And how manly he looked, the tall, frank-faced fellow with the clear, straightforward eyes and the broad shoulders. Anne thought Gilbert was a very handsome lad, even though he didn't look at all like her ideal man. She and Diana had long ago decided what kind of a man they admired, and their tastes seemed exactly similar. He must be very tall and distinguished-looking, with melancholy, inscrutable eyes and a melting, sympathetic voice. There was nothing either melancholy or inscrutable in Gilbert's physiognomy, but of course that didn't matter in friendship. Gilbert stretched himself out on the ferns beside the bubble and looked approvingly at Anne. If Gilbert had been asked to describe his ideal woman, the description would have answered point for point to Anne, even to those 7 tiny freckles whose obnoxious presence still continued to vex her soul.
Gilbert was as yet little more than a boy, but a boy has his dreams, as have others. And in Gilbert's future, there was always a girl with big, limpid gray eyes and a face as fine and delicate as a flower. He had made up his mind also that his future must be worthy of its goddess. Even in quiet Avonlea, there were temptations to be met and faced. White Sands' youth were rather fast set, and Gilbert was popular wherever he went. But he meant to keep himself worthy of Anne's friendship, and perhaps, some distant day, her love. And he watched over word and thought and deed as jealously as if her clear eyes were to pass in judgment on it. She held over him the unconscious influence that every girl, whose ideals are high and pure, wields over her friends, an influence which would endure as long as she was faithful to those ideals, and which she would as certainly lose if she were ever false to them. In Gilbert's eyes, Anne's greatest charm was the fact that she never stooped to the petty practices of so many of the Avonlea girls, the small jealousies, the little deceits and rivalries, the palpable bids for favor. Anne held herself apart from all this, not consciously or of design, but simply because anything of the sort was utterly foreign to her transparent, impulsive nature, crystal clear in its motives and aspirations. But Gilbert did not attempt to put his thoughts into words, for he had already too good reason to know that Anne would mercilessly and frostily nip all attempts at sentiment in the bud, or laugh at him, which was 10 times worse. "He looked like a real dryad under that birch tree," he said teasingly.
"I love birch trees," said Anne, laying her cheek against the creamy satin of the slim bole, with one of the pretty, caressing gestures that came so natural to her.
"Then you'll be glad to hear that Mr. Major Spencer has decided to set out a row of white birches all along the road front of his farm by way of encouraging the AVIS," said Gilbert. "He was talking to me about it today. Major Spencer is the most progressive and public-spirited man in Avonlea. And Mr. William Bell is going to set out a spruce hedge along his road front and up his lane. Our society's getting on splendidly, Anne. It has passed the experimental stage and is an accepted fact. The older folks are beginning to take an interest in it, and the White Sands people are talking of starting one, too. Even Alicia Wright has come around since that day the Americans from the hotel had the picnic at the shore. They praised our roadside so highly and said they were so much prettier than in any other part of the island. And when, in due time, the other farmers follow Mr. Spencer's good example and plant ornamental trees and hedges along their road fronts, Avonlea will be the prettiest settlement in the province."
"The aides are talking of taking up the graveyard," said Anne. "And I hope they will, because there will have to be a subscription for that, and will be no use for the society to try it after the Hall affair."
"But the aides would never have stirred in the matter if the society hadn't put it into their thoughts unofficially. Those trees we planted on the church grounds are flourishing, and the trustees have promised me that they will fence in the school grounds next year. If they do, I'll have an Arbor Day, and every scholar shall plant a tree, and we'll have a garden in the corner by the road."
"We've succeeded in almost all our plans so far, except in getting the old Boulterre house removed," said Gilbert. "And I've given that up in despair. Levi won't have it taken down just to vex us. There's a contrary streak in all the Boulterres, and it's strong developed in him."
"Julia Bell wants to send another committee to him, but I think the better way will just be to leave him severely alone," said Anne sagely.
"And trust to Providence, as Mrs. Lynde says," smiled Gilbert. "Certainly no more committees. They only aggravate him. Julia Bell thinks you can do anything if you only have a committee to attempt it. Next spring, Anne, we must start an agitation for nice lawns and grounds. We'll sow good seeds betimes this winter. I have a treatise here on lawns and lawn making, and I'm going to prepare a paper on the subject soon. Well, I suppose our vacation is almost over. School opens Monday. Has Ruby Gillis got the Carmody School?"
"Yes, Priscilla wrote that she had taken her own home school, so the Carmody trustees gave it to Ruby. I'm sorry Priscilla is not coming back, but since she can't, I'm glad Ruby has got the school. She will be home for Saturdays, and it will seem like old times to have her and Jane and Diana and myself all together again."
Marilla, just home from Mrs. Lynde's, was sitting on the back porch step when Anne returned to the house.
"Rachel and I have decided to have our cruise to town tomorrow," she said. "Mr. Lynde is feeling better this week, and Rachel wants to go before he has another sick spell."
"I intend to get up extra early tomorrow morning, for I've ever so much to do," said Anne virtuously.
For one thing, I'm going to shift the feathers from my old bed tick to the new one. I ought to have done it long ago, but I've just kept putting it off. It's such a detestable task. It's a very bad habit to put off disagreeable things, and I never mean to again, or else I can't comfortably tell my pupils not to do it. That would be inconsistent. Then I want to make a cake for Mr. Harrison, and finish my paper on gardens for the AVIS, and write Stella, and wash and starch my muslin dress, and make Dora's new apron.
"You won't get half done," said Marilla pessimistically. "I never yet planned to do a lot of things, but something happened to prevent me."
Chapter 20. The Way It Often Happens. Anne rose betimes the next morning and blithely greeted the fresh day, when the banners of the sunrise were shaken triumphantly across the pearly skies. Green Gables lay in a pool of sunshine, flecked with the dancing shadows of poplar and willow. Beyond the land was Mr. Harrison's wheat field, a great wind-rippled expanse of pale gold. The world was so beautiful that Anne spent 10 blissful minutes hanging idly over the garden gate, drinking the loveliness in. After breakfast, Marilla made ready for her journey. Dora was to go with her, having been long promised this treat.
"Now, Davy, you try to be a good boy and don't bother Anne," she straitly charged him. "If you're good, I'll bring you a striped candy cane from town."
For alas, Marilla had stooped to the evil habit of bribing people to be good.
"I won't be bad on purpose, but s'posin' I'm bad accidentally," Davy wanted to know. "You'll have to guard against accidents," admonished Marilla.
"And if Mr. Shearer comes today, get a nice roast and some steak. If he doesn't, you'll have to kill a fowl for dinner tomorrow." Anne nodded.
"I'm not going to bother cooking any dinner for just Davy and myself today," she said. "That cold ham bone will do for noon lunch, and I'll have some steak fried for you when you come home at night."
"I'm going to help Mr. Harrison haul Dulce this morning," announced Davy. "He asked me to, and I guess he'll ask me to dinner, too. Mr. Harrison is an awful kind man. He's a real sociable man. I hope I'll be like him when I grow up. I mean, behave like him. I don't want to look like him. I guess there's no danger, for Mrs. Lynde says I'm a very handsome child. Do you suppose it'll last, Anne? I want to know."
"I dare say it will," said Anne gravely. "You are a handsome boy, Davy." Marilla looked volumes of disapproval. "But you must live up to it and be just as nice and gentlemanly as you look to be."
"And you told Minnie May Berry the other day when you found her crying, 'cause someone said she was ugly, that if she was nice and kind and loving, people wouldn't mind her looks," said Davy discontentedly. "Seems to me you can't get out of being good in this world for some reason or another. You just have to behave."
"Don't you want to be good?" asked Marilla, who had learned a great deal, but not yet learned the futility of asking such questions.
"Yes, I want to be good, but not too good," said Davy cautiously. "You don't have to be very good to be a Sunday school superintendent. Mr. Bell's that, and he's a real bad man."
"Indeed he's not," said Marilla indignantly.
"He is? He says he is himself," asseverated Davy. "He said it when he prayed in Sunday school last Sunday. He said he was a vile worm and a miserable sinner, and guilty of the blackest iniquity." "What did he do that was so bad, Marilla? Did he kill anybody, or steal the collection cents? I want to know."
Fortunately, Mrs. Lynde came driving up the lane at this moment, and Marilla made off, feeling that she had escaped from the snare of the fowler, and wishing devoutly that Mr. Bell were not quite so highly figurative in his public petitions, especially in the hearing of small boys who were always wanting to know. Anne, left alone in her glory, worked with a will. The floor was swept, the beds made, the hens fed, the muslin dress washed and hung out on the line. Then Anne prepared for the transfer of feathers. She mounted to the garret and donned the first old dress that came to hand. A navy blue cashmere she had worn at 14. It was decidedly on the short side and as skimpy as the notable wincey Anne had worn upon the occasion of her debut at Green Gables, but at least it would not be materially injured by down and feathers. Anne completed her toilet by tying a big red and white spotted handkerchief that had belonged to Matthew over her head,
and thus accoutred betook herself to the kitchen chamber, whither Marilla, before her departure, had helped her carry the feather bed. A cracked mirror hung by the chamber window, and in an unlucky moment Anne looked into it. There were those 7 freckles on her nose, more rampant than ever, or so it seemed in the glare of light from the unshaded window. "Oh, I forgot to rub that lotion on last night," she thought. "I'd better run down to the pantry and do it now." Anne had already suffered many things trying to remove those freckles. On one occasion, the entire skin had peeled off her nose, but the freckles remained. A few days previously, she had found a recipe for a freckle lotion in a magazine, and as the ingredients were within her reach, she straightway compounded it, much to the disgust of Marilla, who thought that if Providence had placed freckles on your nose, it was your bounden duty to leave them there. Anne scurried down to the pantry, which, always dim from the big willow growing close to the window, was now almost dark by reason of the shade drawn to exclude flies. Anne caught the bottle containing the lotion from the shelf and copiously anointed her nose therewith by means of a little sponge sacred to the purpose. This important duty done, she returned to her work. Anyone who has ever shifted feathers from one tick to another will not need to be told that when Anne finished, she was a sight to behold. Her dress was white with down and fluff, and her front hair, escaping from under the handkerchief, was adorned with a veritable halo of feathers. At this auspicious moment, a knock sounded at the kitchen door. "That must be Mr. Shearer," thought Anne. "I'm in a dreadful mess, but I'll have to run down as I am, for he's always in a hurry." Down flew Anne to the kitchen door. If ever a charitable floor did open to swallow up a miserable, befeathered damsel, the Green Gables porch floor should promptly have engulfed Anne at that moment. On the doorstep were standing Priscilla Grant, golden and fair in silk attire, a short, stout, gray-haired lady in a tweed suit, and another lady, tall, stately, wonderfully gowned, with a beautiful, high-bred face and large, black-lashed violet eyes, whom Anne instinctively felt, as she would have said in her earlier days, to be Mrs. Charlotte E. Morgan. In the dismay of the moment, one thought stood out from the confusion of Anne's mind, and she grasped at it, as at the proverbial straw. All Mrs. Morgan's heroines were noted for rising to the occasion. No matter what their troubles were, they invariably rose to the occasion and showed their superiority over all ills of time, space, and quantity. Anne, therefore, felt it was her duty to rise to the occasion, and she did it, so perfectly that Priscilla afterward declared she never admired Anne Shirley more than at that moment. No matter what her outraged feelings were, she did not show them. She greeted Priscilla and was introduced to her companions as calmly and composedly as if she had been arrayed in purple and fine linen. To be sure, it was somewhat of a shock to find that the lady she had instinctively felt to be Mrs. Morgan was not Mrs. Morgan at all, but an unknown Mrs. Pendexter, while the stout little gray-haired woman was Mrs. Morgan. But in the greater shock, the lesser lost its power. Anne ushered her guests to the spare room and thence into the parlor, where she left them while she hastened out to help Priscilla unharness her horse. "It's dreadful to come upon you so unexpectedly as this," apologized Priscilla, "but I did not know till last night that we were coming. Aunt Charlotte is going away Monday, and she had promised to spend today with a friend in town. But last night her friend telephoned to her not to come because they were quarantined for scarlet fever, so I suggested we come here instead, for I knew you were longing to see her. We called at the White Sands Hotel and brought Mrs. Pendexter with us. She is a friend of Aunt's and lives in New York, and her husband is a millionaire. We can't stay very long, for Mrs. Pendexter has to be back at the hotel by 5 o'clock. Several times while they were putting away the horse, Anne caught Priscilla looking at her in a furtive, puzzled way. "She needn't stare at me so," Anne thought, a little resentfully. "If she doesn't know what it is to change a feather bed, she might imagine it." When Priscilla had gone to the parlor, and before Anne could escape upstairs, Diana walked into the kitchen. Anne caught her astonished friend by the arm. "Diana Barry, who do you suppose is in that parlor at this very moment?" "Mrs. Charlotte E. Morgan, and a New York millionaire's wife,
And here I am like this, and not a thing in the house for dinner but a cold ham bone, Diana.
By this time, Anne had become aware that Diana was staring at her in precisely the same bewildered fashion as Priscilla had done. It was really too much.
"Oh, Diana, don't look at me so," she implored. "You at least must know that the neatest person in the world couldn't empty feathers from one tick into another and remain neat in the process."
"It isn't the feathers," hesitated Diana. "It's your nose, Anne."
"My nose? Oh, Diana, surely nothing's gone wrong with it."
Anne rushed to the little looking-glass over the sink. One glance revealed the fatal truth. Her nose was a brilliant scarlet. Anne sat down on the sofa, her dauntless spirit subdued at last.
"What is the matter with it?"
asked Diana, curiosity overcoming delicacy.
"I thought I was rubbing my freckle lotion on it, but I must have used that red dye Marilla has for marking the pattern on her rugs," was the despairing response. "What shall I do?"
"Wash it off," said Diana practically.
"Perhaps it won't wash off. First I dye my hair, then I dye my nose. Marilla cut my hair off when I dyed it, but that remedy would hardly be practicable in this case. Well, this is another punishment for vanity, and I suppose I deserve it. Though there's not much comfort in that, it is really almost enough to make one believe in ill luck, though Mrs. Lynde says there is no such thing, because everything is foreordained."
Fortunately, the dye washed off easily, and Anne, somewhat consoled, betook herself to the east gable while Diana ran home. Presently, Anne came down again, clothed and in her right mind. The muslin dress she had fondly hoped to wear was bobbing merrily about on the line outside, so she was forced to content herself with her black lawn. She had the fire on and the tea steeping when Diana returned. The latter wore her muslin, at least, and carried a covered platter in her hand.
"Mother sent you this," she said,
lifting the cover and displaying a nicely carved and jointed chicken to Anne's grateful eyes. The chicken was supplemented by light new bread, excellent butter and cheese, Marilla's fruit cake, and a dish of preserved plums floating in their golden syrup as in congealed summer sunshine. There was a big bowlful of pink and white asters also, by way of decoration, yet the spread seemed very meager beside the elaborate one formerly prepared for Mrs. Morgan. Anne's hungry guests, however, did not seem to think anything was lacking, and they ate the simple viands with apparent enjoyment. But after the first few moments, Anne thought no more of what was or was not on her bill of fare. Mrs. Morgan's appearance might be somewhat disappointing, as even her loyal worshippers had been forced to admit to each other, but she proved to be a delightful conversationalist. She had traveled extensively and was an excellent storyteller. She had seen much of men and women and crystallized her experiences into witty little sentences and epigrams which made her hearers feel as if they were listening to one of the people in clever books. But under all her sparkle, there was a strongly felt undercurrent of true womanly sympathy and kind-heartedness, which won affection as easily as her brilliancy won admiration. Nor did she monopolize the conversation. She could draw others out as skillfully and fully as she could talk herself, and Anne and Diana found themselves chattering freely to her. Mrs. Pendexter said little. She merely smiled with her lovely eyes and lips and ate chicken and fruitcake and preserves with such exquisite grace that she conveyed the impression of dining on ambrosia and honeydew. But then, as Anne said to Diana later on, anybody so divinely beautiful as Mrs. Pendexter didn't need to talk. It was enough for her just to look. After dinner, they all had a walk through Lover's Lane and Violet Vale and the Birch Path, then back through the haunted wood to the Dryad's Bubble, where they sat down and talked for a delightful last half hour. Mrs. Morgan wanted to know how the haunted wood came by its name, and laughed until she cried when she heard the story and Anne's dramatic account of a certain memorable walk through it at the witching hour of twilight. "It has indeed been a feast of reason and flow of soul, hasn't it?" said Anne when her guests had gone and she and Diana were alone again. "I don't know which I enjoyed more, listening to Mrs. Morgan or gazing at Mrs. Pendexter. I believe we had a nicer time than if we'd known they were coming and been cumbered with much serving.
You must stay to tea with me, Diana, and we'll talk it all over. Priscilla says Mrs. Pendexter's husband's sister is married to an English earl, and yet she took a second helping of the plum preserves, said Diana, as if the two facts were somehow incompatible. I dare say even the English earl himself wouldn't have turned up his aristocratic nose at Marilla's plum preserves, said Anne proudly. Anne did not mention the misfortune which had befallen her nose when she related the day's history to Marilla that evening, but she took the bottle of freckle lotion and emptied it out of the window. "I shall never try any beautifying messes again," she said, darkly resolute. "They may do for careful, deliberate people, but for anyone so hopelessly given over to making mistakes, as I seem to be, it's tempting fate to meddle with them." Chapter 21. Sweet Miss Lavender. School opened, and Anne returned to her work, with fewer theories, but considerably more experience. She had several new pupils, 6- and 7-year-olds, just venturing, round-eyed, into a world of wonder. Among them were Davy and Dora. Davy sat with Milty Boulter, who had been going to school for a year, and was therefore quite a man of the world. Dora had made a compact at Sunday school the previous Sunday to sit with Lily Sloane, but Lily Sloane not coming the first day, she was temporarily assigned to Mirabel Cotton, who was 10 years old and therefore, in Dora's eyes, one of the big girls. "I think school is great fun," Davy told Marilla when he got home that night. "You said I'd find it hard to sit still, and I did. You mostly do tell the truth, I notice. But you can wriggle your legs about under the desk, and that helps a lot. It's splendid to have so many boys to play with. I sit with Milty Boulter, and he's fine. He's longer than me, but I'm wider. It's nicer to sit in the back seat, but you can't sit there till your legs grow long enough to touch the floor. Milty drawed a picture of Anne on his slate, and it was awful ugly, and I told him if he made pictures of Anne like that, that I'd lick him at recess. I thought first I'd draw one of him and put horns and a tail on it, but I was afraid it would hurt his feelings, and Anne says you should never hurt anyone's feelings. It seems it's dreadful to have your feelings hurt. It's better to knock a boy down than hurt his feelings if you must do something. Milty said he wasn't scared of me, but he'd just as soon call it somebody else to oblige me, so he rubbed out Anne's name and printed Barbara Shaw's under it. Milty doesn't like Barbara because she calls him a sweet little boy, and once she patted him on his head." Dora said primly that she liked school, but she was very quiet, even for her. And when at twilight Marilla bade her go upstairs to bed, she hesitated and began to cry.
I'm frightened, she sobbed. I don't want to go upstairs alone in the dark.
What notion have you got into your head now? Demanded Marilla. I'm sure you've gone to bed alone all summer and never been frightened before. Dora still continued to cry, so Anne picked her up, cuddled her sympathetically, and whispered, "Tell Anne all about it, sweetheart. What are you frightened of?"
Of Mirabel Cotton's uncle," sobbed Dora. "Mirabel Cotton told me all about her family today in school. Nearly everybody in her family has died, all her grandfathers and grandmothers, and ever so many uncles and aunts. They have a habit of dying, Mirabel says. Mirabel's awful proud of having so many dead relations, and she told me what they all died of, and what they said, and how they looked in their coffins. And Mirabel says one of her uncles was seen walking around the house after he was buried. Her mother saw him. I don't mind the rest so much, but I can't help thinking about that uncle."
Anne went upstairs with Dora and sat by her until she fell asleep. The next day Mirabel Cotton was kept in at recess, and gently but firmly given to understand that when you were so unfortunate as to possess an uncle who persisted in walking about houses after he had been decently interred, it was not in good taste to talk about that eccentric gentleman to your deskmate of tender years. Mirabel thought this very harsh. The Cottons had not much to boast of. How was she to keep up her prestige among her schoolmates if she were forbidden to make capital out of the family ghost? September slipped by into a gold and crimson graciousness of October. One Friday evening, Diana came over.
"I had a letter from Ella Kimball today, Anne, and she wants us to go over to tea tomorrow afternoon to meet her cousin, Irene Trent, from town. But we can't get one of our horses to go, for they'll all be in use tomorrow, and your pony is lame, so I suppose we can't go."
"Why can't we walk?" suggested Anne. If we go straight back through the woods, we'll strike the West Grafton Road, not far from the Kimball place. I was through that way last winter, and I know the road. It's no more than 4 miles, and we won't have to walk home, for Oliver Kimball will be sure to drive us. He'll be only too glad of the excuse, for he goes to see Carrie Sloane, and they say his father will hardly ever let him have a horse. It was accordingly arranged that they should walk, and the following afternoon they set out, going by way of Lover's Lane, to the back of the Cuthbert farm, where they found a road leading into the heart of acres of glimmering beech and maple woods, which were all in a wondrous glow of flame and gold, lying in a great purple stillness and peace. It's as if the year were kneeling to pray in a vast cathedral full of mellow-stained light, isn't it? Said Anne dreamily. It doesn't seem right to hurry through it, does it? It seems irreverent, like running in a church. We must hurry, though, said Diana, glancing at her watch. We've left ourselves little enough time as it is. Well, I'll walk fast, but don't ask me to talk, said Anne, quickening her pace. I just want to drink the day's loveliness in. I feel as if she were holding it out to my lips like a cup of airy wine, and I'll take a sip at every step. Perhaps it was because she was so absorbed in drinking it in that Anne took the left turning when they came to a fork in the road. She should have taken the right, but ever afterwards she counted it the most fortunate mistake of her life. They came out finally to a lonely grassy road, with nothing in sight along it but ranks of spruce saplings. "Why, where are we?" exclaimed Diana in bewilderment. "This isn't the West Grafton Road." "No, it's the Baseline Road in Middle Grafton," said Anne, rather shamefacedly. "I must have taken the wrong turning at the fork. I don't know where we are exactly, but we must be all of 3 miles from Kimball still." "And we can't get there by 5, for it's 4:30 now," said Diana, with a despairing look at her watch. "We'll arrive after they have had their tea, and they'll have all the bother of getting ours over again." "We'd better turn back and go home," suggested Anne humbly. But Diana, after consideration, vetoed this. "No, we may as well go and spend the evening, since we have come this far." A few yards further on, the girls came to a place where the road forked again. "Which of these do we take?" asked Diana dubiously. Anne shook her head. "I don't know, and we can't afford to make any more mistakes. Here is a gate and a lane leading right into the wood. There must be a house at the other side. Let us go down and inquire." "What a romantic old lane this is," said Diana as they walked along its twists and turns. It ran under patriarchal old firs, whose branches met above, creating a perpetual gloom in which nothing except moss could grow. On either hand were brown wood floors, crossed here and there by fallen lances of sunlight. All was very still and remote, as if the world and the cares of the world were far away. "I feel as if we were walking through an enchanted forest," said Anne in a hushed tone. "Do you suppose we'll ever find our way back to the real world again, Diana? We shall presently come to a palace with a spellbound princess in it, I think." Around the next turn they came in sight, not indeed of a palace, but of a little house almost as surprising as a palace would have been in this province of conventional wooden farmhouses, all as much alike in general characteristics as if they had grown from the same seed. Anne stopped short in rapture, and Diana exclaimed, "Oh, I know where we are now. That is the little stone house where Miss Lavendar Lewis lives. Echo Lodge, she calls it, I think. I've often heard of it, but I've never seen it before. Isn't it a romantic spot?" "It's the sweetest, prettiest place I ever saw or imagined," said Anne delightedly. "It looks like a bit out of a storybook or a dream." The house was a low-eaved structure built of undressed blocks of red island sandstone, with a little peaked roof out of which peered 2 dormer windows with quaint wooden hoods over them, and 2 great chimneys. The whole house was covered with a luxuriant growth of ivy, finding easy foothold on the rough stonework, and turned by autumn frosts to most beautiful bronze and wine-red tints. Before the house was an oblong garden into which the lane gate where the girls were standing opened. The house bounded it on one side. On the 3 others it was enclosed by an old stone dike, so overgrown with moss and grass and ferns that it looked like a high green bank.
On the right and left, the tall, dark spruces spread their palm branches over it, but below it was a little meadow, green with clover aftermath, sloping down to the blue loop of the Grafton River. No other house or clearing was in sight, nothing but hills and valleys covered with feathery young firs.
"I wonder what sort of a person Miss Lewis is," speculated Diana as they opened the gate into the garden. "They say she is very peculiar."
"She'll be interesting, then," said Anne decidedly. "Peculiar people are always that, at least, whatever else they are or are not.
Didn't I tell you we would come to an enchanted palace? I knew the elves hadn't woven magic over that lane for nothing."
"But Miss Lavendar Lewis is hardly a spellbound princess," laughed Diana. "She's an old maid. She's 45 and quite gray, I've heard."
"Oh, that's only part of the spell," asserted Anne confidently. "At heart she's young and beautiful still, and if we only knew how to unloose the spell, she would step forth radiant and fair again. But we don't know how."
"It's always and only the prince who knows that, and Miss Lavendar's prince hasn't come yet. Perhaps some fatal mischance has befallen him, though that's against the laws of all fairy tales."
"I'm afraid he came long ago and went away again," said Diana. "They say she used to be engaged to Stephen Irving, Paul's father, when they were young, but they quarreled and parted."
"Hush," warned Anne.
"The door is open."
The girls paused in the porch under the tendrils of ivy and knocked at the open door. There was a patter of steps inside, and a rather odd little personage presented herself, a girl of about 14 with a freckled face, a snub nose, a mouth so wide that it really did seem as if it stretched from ear to ear, and two long braids of fair hair tied with two enormous bows of blue ribbon.
"Is Miss Lewis at home?" asked Diana.
"Yes, ma'am. Come in, ma'am. I'll tell Miss Lavendar you're here, ma'am. She's upstairs, ma'am."
With this, the small handmaiden whisked out of sight, and the girls, left alone, looked about them with delighted eyes. The interior of this wonderful little house was quite as interesting as the exterior. The room had a low ceiling and two square, small-paned windows, curtained with muslin frills. All the furnishings were old-fashioned, but so well and daintily kept that the effect was delicious. But it must be candidly admitted that the most attractive feature, to two healthy girls who had just tramped 4 miles through autumn air, was a table set out with pale blue china and laden with delicacies, while little golden-hued ferns scattered over the cloth gave it what Anne would have termed a festal air.
"Miss Lavendar must be expecting company to tea," she whispered. "There are 6 places set, but what a funny little girl she has. She looked like a messenger from Pixieland. I suppose she could have told us the road, but I was curious to see Miss Lavendar's. Shh, she's coming."
And with that, Miss Lavendar Lewis was standing in the doorway. The girls were so surprised that they forgot good manners and simply stared. They had unconsciously been expecting to see the usual type of elderly spinster, as known to their experience, a rather angular personage with prim gray hair and spectacles. Nothing more unlike Miss Lavendar could possibly be imagined. She was a little lady, with snow-white hair beautifully wavy and thick, and carefully arranged in becoming puffs and coils. Beneath it was an almost girlish face, pink-cheeked and sweet-lipped, with big soft brown eyes and dimples, actually dimples. She wore a very dainty gown of cream muslin, with pale-hued roses on it, a gown which would have seemed ridiculously juvenile on most women of her age, but which suited Miss Lavendar so perfectly that you never thought about it at all.
"Charlotta the Fourth says that you wish to see me," she said, in a voice that matched her appearance.
"We wanted to ask the right road to West Grafton," said Diana. "We are invited to tea at Mr. Kimball's, but we took the wrong path coming through the woods and came out to the base line instead of the West Grafton road. Do we take the right or left turning at your gate?"
"The left," said Miss Lavendar, with a hesitating glance at her tea-table. Then she exclaimed, as if in a sudden little burst of resolution,
"But, oh, won't you stay and have tea with me? Please do. Mr. Kimball's will have tea over before you get there, and Charlotta the Fourth and I will be so glad to have you."
Diana looked mute inquiry at Anne.
"We'd like to stay," said Anne promptly,
for she had made up her mind that she wanted to know more of this surprising Miss Lavendar.
"If it won't inconvenience you. But you are expecting other guests, aren't you?"
Miss Lavendar looked at her tea table again and blushed. "I know you'll think me dreadfully foolish," she said. "I am foolish, and I'm ashamed of it when I'm found out, but never unless I am found out. I'm not expecting anybody. I was just pretending I was. You see, I was so lonely. I love company. That is the right kind of company. But so few people ever come here because it is so far out of the way. Charlotta the Fourth was lonely, too. So I just pretended I was going to have a tea party. I cooked for it and decorated the table for it and set it with my mother's wedding china. And I dressed up for it." Diana secretly thought Miss Lavendar quite as peculiar as report had pictured her. The idea of a woman of 45 playing at having a tea party, just as if she were a little girl? But Anne of the Shining Eyes exclaimed joyfully, "Oh, do you imagine things, too?" That, too, revealed a kindred spirit to Miss Lavendar. "Yes, I do," she confessed boldly. "Of course, it's silly in anybody as old as I am. But what is the use of being an independent old maid if you can't be silly when you want to, and when it doesn't hurt anybody? A person must have some compensations. I don't believe I could live at times if I didn't pretend things. I'm not often caught at it, though, and Charlotta the Fourth never tells. But I'm glad to be caught today, for you have really come, and I have tea all ready for you. Will you go up to the spare room and take off your hats? It's the white door at the head of the stairs. I must run out to the kitchen and see that Charlotta the Fourth isn't letting the tea boil. Charlotta the Fourth is a very good girl, but she will let the tea boil." Miss Lavendar tripped off to the kitchen on hospitable thoughts intent, and the girls found their way up to the spare room, an apartment as white as its door, lighted by the ivy-hung dormer window, and looking, as Anne said, like the place where happy dreams grew. "This is quite an adventure, isn't it?" said Diana. "And isn't Miss Lavendar sweet, if she is a little odd? She doesn't look a bit like an old maid." "She looks just as music sounds, I think," answered Anne. When they went down, Miss Lavendar was carrying in the teapot, and behind her, looking vastly pleased, was Charlotta the Fourth, with a plate of hot biscuits. "Now, you must tell me your names," said Miss Lavendar. "I'm so glad you are young girls. I love young girls. It's so easy to pretend I'm a girl myself when I'm with them. I do hate," with a little grimace, "to believe I'm old. Now, who are you, just for convenience's sake? Diana Barry? And Anne Shirley? May I pretend that I've known you 100 years and call you Anne and Diana right away?" "You may," the girls said, both together. "Then just let's sit comfily down and eat everything," said Miss Lavendar happily. "Charlotta, you sit at the foot and help with the chicken. It is so fortunate that I made the sponge cake and doughnuts. Of course, it was foolish to do it with imaginary guests." "I know Charlotta the Fourth thought so, didn't you, Charlotta? But you see how well it has turned out. Of course, they wouldn't have been wasted, for Charlotta the Fourth and I could have eaten them through time. But sponge cake is not a thing that improves with time." That was a merry and memorable meal, and when it was all over, they went out to the garden, lying in the glamour of sunset. "I do think you have the loveliest place here," said Diana, looking round her admiringly. "Why do you call it Echo Lodge?" asked Anne. "Charlotta," said Miss Lavendar, "go into the house and bring out the little tin horn that is hanging over the clock shelf." Charlotta the Fourth skipped off and returned with the horn. "Blow on it, Charlotta," commanded Miss Lavendar. Charlotta accordingly blew a rather raucous, strident blast. There was a moment's stillness, and then from the woods over the river came a multitude of fairy echoes, sweet, elusive, silvery, as if all the horns of Elfland were blowing against the sunset. Anne and Diana exclaimed in delight. "Now laugh, Charlotta. Laugh loudly." Charlotta, who would probably have obeyed if Miss Lavendar had told her to stand on her head, climbed upon the stone bench and laughed loud and heartily. Back came the echoes, as if a host of pixie people were mimicking her laughter in the purple woodlands and along the fir-fringed points. "People always admire my echoes very much," said Miss Lavendar, as if the echoes were her personal property. "I love them myself. They are very good company, with a little pretending. On calm evenings, Charlotta the Fourth and I often sit out here and amuse ourselves with them. Charlotta, take back the horn and hang it carefully in its place." "Why do you call her Charlotta the Fourth?"
asked Diana, who was bursting with curiosity on this point.
"Just to keep her from getting mixed up with the other Charlottas in my thoughts," said Miss Lavendar seriously. "They all look so much alike, there's no telling them apart. Her name isn't really Charlotta at all. It is... let me see. What is it? I think it's Leonora. Yes, it is Leonora. You see, it is this way. When Mother died 10 years ago, I couldn't stay here alone. I couldn't afford to pay the wages of a grown-up girl. So I got little Charlotta Bowman to come and stay with me for board and clothes. Her name really was Charlotta. She was Charlotta the First. She was just 13. She stayed with me till she was 16, and then she went away to Boston, because she could do better there. Her sister came to stay with me then. Her name was Julietta. Mrs. Bowman had a weakness for fancy names, I think. But she looked so like Charlotta that I kept calling her that all the time, and she didn't mind. So I gave up trying to remember her right name. She was Charlotta the Second, and when she went away, Evelina came, and she was Charlotta the Third. Now I have Charlotta the Fourth, but when she is 16, she's 14 now, she will want to go to Boston, too. And what I shall do then, I really do not know. Charlotta the Fourth is the last of the Bowman girls, and the best. The other Charlottas always let me see that they thought it silly of me to pretend things, but Charlotta the Fourth never does, no matter what she may really think. I don't care what people think about me if they don't let me see it. Well, said Diana, looking regretfully at the setting sun, I suppose we must go if we want to get to Mr. Kimball's before dark. We've had a lovely time, Miss Lewis. Won't you come again to see me? Pleaded Miss Lavendar. Tall Anne put her arm about the little lady. Indeed we shall, she promised. Now that we have discovered you, we'll wear out our welcome coming to see you. Yes, we must go. We must tear ourselves away, as Paul Irving says every time he comes to Green Gables. Paul Irving? There was a subtle change in Miss Lavendar's voice. Who is he? I didn't think there was anybody of that name in Avonlea. Anne felt vexed at her own heedlessness. She had forgotten about Miss Lavendar's old romance when Paul's name slipped out. He is a little pupil of mine, she explained slowly. He came from Boston last year to live with his grandmother, Mrs. Irving of the Shore Road. Is he Stephen Irving's son? Miss Lavendar asked, bending over her namesake border so that her face was hidden. Yes. I'm going to give you girls a bunch of lavender apiece, said Miss Lavendar brightly, as if she had not heard the answer to her question. It's very sweet, don't you think? Mother always loved it. She planted these borders long ago. Father named me Lavendar because he was so fond of it. The very first time he saw Mother was when he visited her home in East Grafton with her brother. He fell in love with her at first sight, and they put him in the spare room bed to sleep, and the sheets were scented with lavender, and he lay awake all night and thought of her. He always loved the scent of lavender after that, and that was why he gave me the name. Don't forget to come back soon, girls, dear. We'll be looking for you, Charlotta the Fourth and I.
She opened the gate under the firs for them to pass through. She looked suddenly old and tired. The glow and radiance had faded from her face. Her parting smile was as sweet with ineradicable youth as ever, but when the girls looked back from the first curve in the lane, they saw her sitting on the old stone bench under the silver poplar in the middle of the garden, with her head leaning wearily on her hand.
"She does look lonely," said Diana softly. "We must come often to see her."
"I think her parents gave her the only right and fitting name that could possibly be given her," said Anne. "If they had been so blind as to name her Elizabeth or Nellie or Muriel, she might have been called Lavendar just the same, I think. It's so suggestive of sweetness and old-fashioned graces and silk attire. Now my name just smacks of bread and butter, patchwork and chores."
"Oh, I don't think so," said Diana. "Anne seems to me real stately and like a queen. But I'd like Karen Happock, if it happened to be your name. I think people make their names nice or ugly just by what they are themselves. I can't bear Josie or Gertie for names now, but before I knew the Pye girls, I thought them real pretty."
"That's a lovely idea, Diana," said Anne enthusiastically. "Living so that you beautify your name, even if it wasn't beautiful to begin with. making it stand in people's thoughts for something so lovely and pleasant that they can never think of it by itself. Thank you, Diana.
Chapter 22. Odds and Ends.
So you had tea at the Stone House with Lavender Lewis? Said Marilla at the breakfast table next morning. What is she like now? It's over 15 years since I saw her last. It was one Sunday in Grafton Church. I suppose she has changed a great deal. Davy Keith, when you want something you can't reach, ask to have it passed, and don't spread yourself over the table in that fashion. Did you ever see Paul Irving doing that when he was here to meals?
But Paul's arms are longer than mine, brumbled Davy. They've had 11 years to grow, and mine have only had 7. Sides, I did ask, but you and Anne was so busy talking you didn't pay any attention.
Sides, Paul's never been here to any meal except tea, and it's easier to be polite at tea than at breakfast. You ain't half as hungry. It's an awful long while between supper and breakfast. Now, Anne, that spoonful ain't any bigger than it was last year, and I'm ever so much bigger.
Of course, I don't know what Miss Lavender used to look like. But I don't fancy somehow that she has changed a great deal, said Anne, after she had helped Davy to maple syrup, giving him 2 spoonfuls to pacify him.
Her hair is snow-white, but her face is fresh and almost girlish, and she has the sweetest brown eyes, such a pretty shade of wood-brown with little golden glints in them, and her voice makes you think of white satin and tinkling water and fairy bells all mixed up together.
She was reckoned a great beauty when she was a girl, said Marilla. I never knew her very well, but I liked her as far as I did know her. Some folks thought her peculiar even then. Davy, if ever I catch you at such a trick again, you'll be made to wait for your meals till everyone else is done, like the French.
Most conversations between Anne and Marilla in the presence of the twins were punctuated by these rebukes Davy-ward. In this instance, Davy, sad to relate, not being able to scoop up the last drops of his syrup with his spoon, had solved the difficulty by lifting his plate in both hands and applying his small pink tongue to it. Anne looked at him with such horrified eyes that the little sinner turned red and said, half shamefacedly, half defiantly,
"There ain't any wasted that way."
"People who are different from other people are always called peculiar," said Anne. "And Miss Lavender is certainly different, though it's hard to say just where the difference comes in. Perhaps it is because she is one of those people who never grow old."
"One might as well grow old when all your generation do," said Marilla, rather reckless of her pronouns. "If you don't, you don't fit in anywhere. As far as I can learn, Lavender Lewis has just dropped out of everything. She's lived in that out-of-the-way place until everybody has forgotten her. That stone house is one of the oldest on the island. Old Mr. Lewis built it 80 years ago when he came out from England. Davy, stop joggling Dora's elbow. Oh, I saw you. You needn't try to look innocent. What does make you behave so this morning?"
"Maybe I got out of the wrong side of the bed," suggested Davy. "Milty Volterra says if you do that, things are bound to go wrong with you all day, his grandmother told him. But which is the right side, and what are you to do when your bed's against the wall? I want to know."
"I've always wondered what went wrong between Stephen Irving and Lavender Lewis," continued Marilla, ignoring Davy. "They were certainly engaged 25 years ago, and then all at once it was broken off. I don't know what the trouble was, but it must have been something terrible, for he went away to the States, never come home since."
"Perhaps it was nothing very dreadful after all. I think the little things in life often make more trouble than the big things," said Anne, with one of those flashes of insight which experience could not have bettered.
"Marilla, please don't say anything about my being at Miss Lavender's to Mrs. Lynde. She'll be sure to ask 100 questions, and somehow I wouldn't like it. Nor Miss Lavender, either, if she knew, I feel sure."
"I dare say Rachel would be curious," admitted Marilla, "though she hasn't as much time as she used to have for looking after other people's affairs. She's tied home now on account of Thomas, and she's feeling pretty downhearted, for I think she's beginning to lose hope of his ever getting better. Rachel will be left pretty lonely if anything happens to him, with all her children settled out west, except Eliza in town, and she doesn't like her husband.